or ignoble. Consider a scenario in which your loved one has just died, and now the funeral director, who knows that you know next to nothing about his business and are under emotional duress to boot, steers you to the $7,000 mahogany casket. Or consider the automobile dealership. The salesman does his best to obscure the car's base price under a mountain of add-ons and incentives. Later, however, in the cool-headed calm of your home, you can use the internet to find out exactly how much the dealer paid the manufacturer for that car. Or you might just log on to www.tributedirect.com and buy that mahogany casket yourself for just $3,200 delivered overnight. Unless you decide to spend $2,995 for The Last Hole, a casket with golf scenes, or Memories of the Hunt, featuring big rack bucks and other prey, or one of the much cheaper models that the funeral director somehow failed to even mention. The internet, powerful as it is, has hardly slain the beast that is information asymmetry. Consider the so-called corporate scandals of the early 2000s. The crimes committed by Enron included hidden partnerships, disguised debt, and the manipulation of energy markets. Henry Blodgett of Merrill Lynch and Jack Grubman of Salomon Smith Barney wrote glowing research reports of companies they knew to be junk. Sam Waxel dumped his ImClone shares when he got early word of a damaging report from the Food and Drug Administration. His friend Martha Stewart also dumped her shares, then lied about the reason. WorldCom and Global Crossing fabricated billions of dollars in revenues to pump up their stock prices. One group of mutual fund companies let preferred customers trade at preferred prices, and another group was charged with hiding management fees. Though extraordinarily diverse, these crimes all have a common trait. They were sins of information. Most of them involved an expert or a gang of experts promoting false information or hiding true information. In each case, the experts were trying to keep the information asymmetry as asymmetrical as possible. The practitioners of such acts, especially in the realm of high finance, inevitably offer this defense. Everybody else was doing it. Which may be largely true. One characteristic of information crimes is that very few of them are detected. Unlike street crimes, they do not leave behind a corpse or a broken window. Unlike a bagel criminal, that is, someone who eats one of Paul Feldman's bagels but doesn't pay, an information criminal typically doesn't have someone like Feldman tallying every nickel. For an information crime to reach the surface, something drastic must happen. When it does, the results tend to be pretty revealing. The perpetrators, after all, weren't thinking about their private actions being made public. Consider the Enron tapes, the secretly recorded conversations of Enron employees that surfaced after the company imploded. During a phone conversation on August 5th, 2000, two traders chatted about how a wildfire in California would allow Enron to jack up its electricity prices. "The magical word of the day," said one trader, "is burn, baby, burn." A few months later, a pair of Enron traders named Kevin and Tom talked about how California officials wanted to make Enron refund the profits of its price gouging. Kevin: "They're fucking taking all the money back from you guys? All the money you stole from those poor grandmas in California?" Bob: "Yeah, Grandma Millie, man." Kevin: "Yeah, now she wants her fucking money back for all the power you jammed right up her ass for fucking $250 a megawatt hour." If you were to assume that many experts use their information to your detriment, you'd be right. Experts depend on the fact that you don't have the information they do, or that you were so befuddled by the complexity of their operation that you wouldn't know what to do with the information if you had it. Or that you were so in awe of their expertise that you wouldn't dare challenge them. If your doctor suggests that you have angioplasty, even though some current research suggests that angioplasty does little to prevent heart attacks, you aren't likely to think that the doctor is using his informational advantage to make a few thousand dollars for himself or his buddy. But as David Hillis, an interventional cardiologist at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas explained to the New York Times, a doctor may have the same economic incentives as a car salesman or a funeral director or a mutual fund manager. If you're an invasive cardiologist, said David Hillis, and Joe Smith, the local internist, is sending you patients, and if you tell them they don't need the procedure, pretty soon Joe Smith doesn't send patients anymore. Armed with information, experts can exert a gigantic, if unspoken, leverage. Fear. Fear that your children will find you dead on the bathroom floor of a heart attack if you do not have angioplasty surgery. Fear that a cheap casket will expose your grandmother to a terrible underground fate. Fear that a $25,000 car will crumple like a toy in an accident, whereas a $50,000 car will wrap your loved ones in a cocoon of impregnable steel. The fear created by commercial experts may not quite rival the fear created by terrorists like the Ku Klux Klan, but the principle is the same. Consider a transaction that wouldn't seem, on the surface, to create much fear. Selling your house. What's so scary about that? Aside from the fact that selling your house is typically the largest financial transaction in your life, and that you probably have scant experience in real estate, and that you may have an enormous emotional attachment to your house, there are at least two pressing fears. That you will sell the house for far less than it is worth, and that you will not be able to sell it at all. In the first case, you fear setting the price too low. In the second, you fear setting it too high. It is the job of your real estate agent, of course, to find the golden mean. She is the one with all the information, the inventory of similar houses, the recent sales trends, the tremors of the mortgage market, perhaps even a lead on an interested buyer. You feel fortunate to have such a knowledgeable expert as an ally in this most confounding enterprise. Too bad she sees things differently. A real estate agent may see you not so much as an ally, but as a mark. Think back to the study cited at the beginning of this recording, which measured the difference between the sales price of homes that belonged to real estate agents themselves and the houses they sold for their clients. The study found that an agent keeps her own house on the market an average 10 extra days, waiting for a better offer, and sells it for over 3% more than your house, or $10,000 on the sale of a $300,000 house. That's $10,000 going into her pocket that does not go into yours, a nifty profit produced by the abuse of information and a keen understanding of incentives. The problem is that the agent only stands to personally gain an additional $150 by selling your house for $10,000 more, which isn't much reward for a lot of extra work. So her job is to convince you that a $300,000 offer is in fact a very good offer, even a generous one, and that only a fool would refuse it. This can be tricky. The agent does not want to come right out and call you a fool, so she merely implies it, perhaps by telling you about the much bigger, nicer, newer house down the block that has sat unsold for 6 months. Here is the agent's main weapon, the conversion of information into fear. Consider this true story, related by John Donahue, a law professor who in 2001 was teaching at Stanford University. I was just about to buy a house on the Stanford campus, he recalls, and the seller's agent kept telling me what a good deal I was getting because the market was about to zoom. As soon as I signed the purchase contract, he asked me if I would need an agent to sell my previous Stanford house. I told him that I would probably try to sell without an agent, and he replied, John, that might work under normal conditions, but with the market tanking now, you really need the help of a broker. Within 5 minutes, a zooming market had tanked. Such are the marvels that can be conjured by an agent in search of the next deal. Consider now another true story of a real estate agent's information abuse. This tale involves someone we'll call T, a close friend of one of this book's authors. T wanted to buy a house that was listed at $469,000. He was prepared to offer $450,000, but he first called the seller's agent and asked her to name the lowest price that she thought the homeowner might accept. The agent promptly scolded T. You ought to be ashamed of yourself, she said. That is clearly a violation of real estate ethics. T apologized. The conversation turned to other, more mundane issues. After 10 minutes, as the conversation was ending, the agent told T, Let me say one last thing. My client is willing to sell this house for a lot less than you might think. Based on this conversation, T then offered $425,000 for the house instead of the $450,000 he had planned to offer. In the end, the seller accepted $430,000. Thanks to his own agent's intervention, the seller lost at least $20,000. The agent, meanwhile, only lost $300, a small price to pay to ensure that she would quickly and easily lock up the sale, which netted her a commission of $6,450. So a big part of a real estate agent's job, it would seem, is to persuade the homeowner to sell for less than he would like, while at the same time letting potential buyers know that a house can be bought for less than its listing price. To be sure, there are more subtle means of doing so than coming right out and telling the buyer to bid low. The study of real estate agents cited earlier also reveals how agents convey information through the for sale ads they write. A phrase like well-maintained, for instance, is as full of meaning to an agent as Mr. Ayak was to a Klansman. What well-maintained means is that a house is old but not quite falling down. A savvy buyer will know this or find out for himself once he sees the house, but to the 65-year-old retiree who is selling his house, well-maintained might sound like a compliment, which is just what the agent intends. An analysis of the language used in real estate ads shows that certain words are powerfully correlated with the final sale price of a house. This doesn't necessarily mean that labeling a house well-maintained causes it to sell for less than an equivalent house. It does, however, indicate that when a real estate agent labels a house well-maintained, she is subtly encouraging a buyer to bid low. Here now are 10 terms commonly used in real estate ads. 5 of them have a strong positive correlation to the ultimate sales price, and 5 have a strong negative correlation. Feel free to guess which are which. Fantastic, granite, spacious, state-of-the-art, an exclamation point, Corian, charming, maple, great neighborhood, gourmet. A fantastic house is surely fantastic enough to warrant a high price, isn't it? What about a, quote, charming and, quote, spacious house in a, quote, great neighborhood? No, 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 and no. Here's the breakdown. These are the 5 terms correlated to a higher sales price. Granite, state-of-the-art, Corian, maple, and gourmet. And the 5 correlated to a lower sales price. Fantastic, spacious, charming, great neighborhood, and the exclamation point. 3 of the 5 terms correlated with a higher sales price are physical descriptions of the house itself. Granite, Corian, and maple. As information goes, such terms are specific and straightforward, and therefore pretty useful. If you like granite, you might like the house. But even if you don't, the word granite certainly does not connote a fixer-upper. Nor does the word gourmet or state-of-the-art, both of which seem to tell a buyer that a house is, on some level, fantastic. The word fantastic, meanwhile, is a dangerously ambiguous adjective, as is charming. Both these words seem to be real estate agent code for a house that doesn't have many specific attributes worth describing. Quote, spacious homes, meanwhile, are often decrepit or impractical. Great neighborhood signals a buyer that, well, this house isn't very nice, but others nearby may be. And an exclamation point in a real estate ad is bad news for sure, a bid to paper over real shortcomings with false enthusiasm. If you study the words in the ad for a real estate agent's own home, meanwhile, you see that she indeed emphasizes descriptive terms, especially new, granite, maple, and move-in condition, and avoids empty adjectives, including wonderful, immaculate, and the telltale exclamation point. She patiently waits for the best buyer to come along. She might tell this buyer about a house nearby that just sold for $25,000 above the asking price, or another house that is currently the subject of a bidding war. She is careful to exercise every advantage of the information asymmetry she enjoys. But, like the funeral director and the car salesman and the life insurance company, the real estate agent's advantage has also been eroded by the internet. After all, anyone selling a home can now get online and gather her own information about sales trends and housing inventory and mortgage rate tremors. The information has been set loose. And recent sales data show the results. Real estate agents still get a higher price for their own homes than comparable homes owned by their clients, but since the proliferation of real estate websites, the gap between the two prices has shrunk by a third. It would be naive to suppose that people abuse information only when they are acting as experts or agents of commerce. Agents and experts are people too, which suggests that we are likely to abuse information in our personal lives as well, whether by withholding true information or editing the information we choose to put forth. A real estate agent may wink and nod when she lists a well-maintained house, but we each have our equivalent hedges. Think about how you describe yourself during a job interview versus how you might describe yourself on a first date. For even more fun, compare that first date conversation to a conversation with the same person during your 10th year of marriage. Or think about how you might present yourself if you were going on national television for the first time. What sort of image would you want to project? Perhaps you want to seem clever or kind or good-looking. Presumably you don't want to come off as cruel or bigoted. During the heyday of the Ku Klux Klan, its members took pride in publicly disparaging anybody who wasn't a conservative white Christian. But public bigotry has since been vastly curtailed. Even subtle displays of bigotry, if they become public, are now costly. Trent Lott, the majority leader of the U.S. Senate, learned this in 2002 after making a toast at a 100th birthday party for Strom Thurmond, his fellow senator and a fellow Southerner. Lott made a reference in his toast to Thurmond's 1948 campaign for president, which was built on a platform of segregation. Mississippi, Lott's home state, was one of just four states that Thurmond carried. "We're proud of it," Lott told the partygoers, "and if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all these years either." The implication that Lott was a fan of segregation raised enough of a fury that he was forced to quit his Senate leadership post. Even if you were a private citizen, you surely wouldn't want to seem bigoted while appearing in public. Might there be a way to test for discrimination in a public setting? Unlikely as it may seem, the television game show The Weakest Link provides a unique laboratory to study discrimination. An import from the United Kingdom, The Weakest Link for a short time became wildly popular in the United States. The game includes 8 contestants, or in a later daytime version, 6, who each answer trivia questions and compete for a single cash jackpot. But the player who answers the most questions correctly isn't necessarily the player who advances. After each round, every contestant votes to eliminate one other contestant. A player's trivia answering ability is presumably the only worthwhile factor to consider. Race, gender, and age wouldn't seem to matter. But do they? By measuring a contestant's actual votes against the votes that would truly best serve his self-interest, it's possible to tell if discrimination is at play. The voting strategy changes as the game progresses. In the first several rounds, it makes sense to eliminate bad players, since the jackpot only grows when correct answers are given. In later rounds, the strategic incentives are flipped. The value of building the jackpot is now outweighed by each contestant's desire to win the jackpot. It's easier to do that if you eliminate the other good players. So, roughly speaking, the typical contestant will vote to eliminate the worst players in the early rounds and the better players in the later rounds. The key to measuring the weakest link voting data is to tease out a contestant's playing ability from his race, gender, and age. If a young black man answers a lot of questions correctly but is voted off early, discrimination would seem to be a factor. Meanwhile, if an elderly white woman doesn't answer a single question correctly and is still not voted off, some sort of discriminatory favoritism would seem to be at play. Again, keep in mind that all of this is happening on camera. A contestant knows that his friends, family, and coworkers are watching. So who, if anyone, is discriminated against on The Weakest Link? not, as it turns out, blacks. An analysis of more than 160 episodes reveals that black contestants, in both the early and late rounds of the game, are eliminated at a rate commensurate with their trivia answering abilities. The same is true for female contestants. In a way, neither of these findings is so surprising. Two of the most potent social campaigns of the past half century were the civil rights movement and the feminist movement, which demonized discrimination against blacks and women, respectively. So perhaps, you say hopefully, discrimination was practically eradicated during the 20th century, like polio. Or more likely, it has become so unfashionable to discriminate against certain groups that all but the most insensitive people take pains to at least appear fair-minded, at least in public. This hardly means that discrimination itself has ended, only that people are embarrassed to show it. How might you determine whether the lack of discrimination against blacks and women represents a true absence or just a charade? The answer can be found by looking at other groups that society doesn't protect as well. Indeed, the weakest link voting data do indicate two kinds of contestants who are consistently discriminated against, the elderly and Hispanics. Among economists, there are two leading theories of discrimination. Interestingly, elderly weakest link contestants seem to suffer from one type of discrimination, while Hispanics suffer the other. The first type is called taste-based discrimination, which means that one person discriminates simply because he prefers to not interact with a particular type of other person. In the second type, known as information-based discrimination, one person believes that another type of person has poor skills and acts accordingly. On the weakest link, Hispanics suffer information-based discrimination. Other contestants seem to view the Hispanics as poor players, even when they are not. This perception translates into Hispanics being eliminated in the early rounds, even if they are doing well, and not eliminated in the later rounds, when other contestants want to keep the Hispanics around to weaken the field. Elderly players, meanwhile, are victims of taste-based discrimination. In the early rounds and late rounds, they are eliminated far out of proportion to their skills. It seems as if the other contestants, this is a show on which the average age is 34, simply don't want the older players around. It's quite possible that a typical weakest link contestant isn't even cognizant of his discrimination toward Hispanics and the elderly, or, in the case of blacks and women, his lack of discrimination. He is bound to be nervous, after all, and excited, playing a fast-moving game under the glare of television lights, which naturally suggests another question. How might that same person express his preferences and reveal information about himself in the privacy of his home? In a given year, some 40 million Americans swap intimate truths about themselves with complete strangers. It all happens on internet dating sites. Some of them, like Match.com, eHarmony.com, and Yahoo Singles, appeal to a broad audience. Others cater to more specific tastes, ChristianSingles.com, JDate.com, LatinMatcher.com, BlackSinglesConnection.com, CountryWesternSingles.com, USMilitarySingles.com, PlusSizeSingles.com, and Gay.com. Dating websites are the most successful subscription-based business on the internet. Each site operates a bit differently, but the gist is this. You compose a personal ad about yourself that typically includes a photo, vital statistics, your income range, level of education, likes and dislikes, and so on. If the ad catches someone's fancy, that someone will email you and perhaps arrange a date. On many sites, you also specify your dating aims. Long-term relationship, or a casual lover, or just looking. So there are two massive layers of data to be mined here. The information that people include in their ads, and the level of response gleaned by any particular ad. Each layer of the data can be asked its own question. In the case of the ads, how forthright and honest are people when it comes to sharing their personal information? And in the case of the responses, what kind of information in personal ads is considered the most, or least, desirable? two economists and a psychologist recently banded together to address these questions. Ali Hortaksu, Gunther Hitch, and Don Ariely analyzed the data from one of the mainstream dating sites, focusing on roughly 30,000 users, half in Boston and half in San Diego. 57% of the users were men, and the median age range for all users was 26 to 35. Although they represented an adequate racial mix to reach some conclusions about race, they were predominantly white. They were also a lot richer, taller, skinnier, and better looking than average. That, at least, is what they wrote about themselves. More than 4% of the online daters claimed to make over $200,000 a year, whereas fewer than 1% of typical internet users actually earn that much, suggesting that three of the four big earners were exaggerating. Male and female users typically reported that they are about an inch taller than the national average. As for weight, the men were in line with the national average, but the women typically said they weighed about 20 pounds less than the national average. Most impressively, fully 70% of the women claimed, quote, above average looks, including 24% claiming very good looks. The online men, too, were gorgeous. 67% called themselves above average, including 21% with very good looks. This leaves only about 30% of the users with average looks, including a paltry 1% with less than average looks, which suggests that the typical online dater is either a fabulist, a narcissist, or simply resistant to the meaning of average. Or perhaps they are all just realists. As any real estate agent knows, the typical house isn't charming or fantastic, but unless you say it is, no one will even bother to come for a look. 28% of the women on the site said they were blonde, a number far beyond the national average, which indicates a lot of dying or lying or both. Some users, meanwhile, were bracingly honest. 8% of the men, about 1 in every 12, conceded that they were married, with half of these 8% reporting that they were, quote, happily married. But the fact that they were honest doesn't mean they were rash. Of the 258 happily married men in the sample, only 9 chose to post a picture of themselves. The reward of gaining a mistress was evidently outweighed by the risk of having your wife discover your personal ad. And what were you doing on that website, the husband might bluster, undoubtedly to no avail. Of the many ways to fail on a dating website, not posting a photo of yourself is perhaps the most certain. Not that the photo necessarily is a photo of yourself. It may be some better-looking stranger, but such deception would obviously backfire in time. A man who does not include his photo gets only 1/4 the volume of email response of a man who does. A woman who doesn't include her photo gets only 1/6 the response. A low-income, poorly educated, unhappily employed, not very attractive, slightly overweight, and balding man who posts his photo stands a better chance of gleaning some emails than a man who says he makes $200,000 and is deadly handsome but doesn't post a photo. There are plenty of reasons someone might not post a photo. He's technically challenged, or is ashamed of being spotted by friends, or he's just plain unattractive. But as in the case of a brand new car with a for sale sign, prospective customers will assume he's got something seriously wrong under the hood. Getting a date is hard enough as it is. 57% of the men who post ads don't get even one email. 23% of the women don't get a single response. The traits that do draw a big response, meanwhile, will not be a big surprise to anyone with even a passing knowledge of the sexes. In fact, the preferences expressed by online daters fit snugly with the most common stereotypes about men and women. For instance, men who say they want a long-term relationship do much better than men looking for an occasional lover. But women looking for an occasional lover do great. For men, a woman's looks are of paramount importance. For women, a man's income is terribly important. The richer a man is, the more emails he receives. But a woman's income appeal is a bell-shaped curve. Men do not want to date low-earning women, but once a woman starts earning too much, men seem to be scared off. Men want to date students, artists, musicians, veterinarians, and celebrities, while avoiding secretaries, retirees, and women in the military and law enforcement. Women do want to date military men, policemen, and firemen, possibly the result of a 9/11 effect, like the higher payments to Paul Feldman's bagel business, as well as lawyers and financial executives. Women avoid laborers, actors, students, and men who work in food services or hospitality. For men, being short is a big disadvantage, which is probably why so many lie about it. But weight doesn't much matter. For women, being overweight is deadly, which is probably why they lie. For a man, having red hair or curly hair is a downer, as is baldness, but a shaved head is okay. For a woman, salt and pepper hair is bad, while blonde hair is very good. In addition to all the information about income, education, and looks, men and women on the dating site also listed their race. Furthermore, they were asked to indicate a preference regarding the race of their potential dates. The two preferences were, quote, the same as mine, or, quote, it doesn't matter. Like the contestants on The Weakest Link, the website users were now publicly declaring how they felt about people who didn't look like them. They would act on their actual preferences later, in confidential emails to the people they wanted to date. Roughly half of the white women on the site and 80% of the white men declared that race didn't matter to them. But the response data tell a different story. The white men who said that race didn't matter sent 90% of their email queries to white women. The white women who said race didn't matter sent about 97% of their email queries to white men. Is it possible that race really didn't matter for these white women and men, and that they simply never happened to browse a non-white date that interested them? Or, more likely, did they say that race didn't matter because they wanted to come across, especially to potential mates of their own, as open-minded? The gulf between the information we publicly proclaim and the information we know to be true is often vast, or, put a more familiar way, we say one thing and do another. This can be seen in personal relationships, in commercial transactions, and, of course, in politics. By now, we are fully accustomed to the false public proclamations of politicians themselves. But voters lie, too. Consider an election between a black candidate and a white candidate. Might white voters lie to pollsters, claiming they will vote for the black candidate in order to appear more colorblind than they actually are? Apparently so. In New York City's 1989 mayoral race between David Dinkins, a black candidate, and Rudolph Giuliani, who is white, Dinkins won by only a few points. Although Dinkins became the city's first black mayor, his slender margin of victory came as a surprise, for pre-election polls showed Dinkins winning by nearly 15 points. When the white supremacist David Duke ran for the U.S. Senate in 1990, he garnered nearly 20% more of the vote than pre-election polls had projected, an indication that thousands of Louisiana voters did not want to admit their preference for a candidate with racist views. Duke, though he never won the high political office he sought, proved himself a master of information abuse. As Grand Wizard of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, he was able to compile a mailing list of thousands of rank-and-file Klansmen and other supporters who would eventually become his political base. Not content to use the list only for himself, he sold it for $150,000 to the governor of Louisiana. Years later, Duke would once again use the list himself, letting his supporters know that he'd fallen on hard times and needed their donations. In this way, Duke was able to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars for his continuing work in the field of white supremacy. He had explained to his supporters in a letter that he was so broke that the bank was trying to repossess his house. In truth, Duke had already sold his house for a solid profit. It isn't known whether he used a real estate agent. And most of the money he raised from his supporters was being used not to promote any white supremacist cause, but rather to satisfy Duke's gambling habit. It was a sweet little scam he was running until he was arrested and sent to federal prison in Big Spring, Texas. Chapter 3. Why do drug dealers still live with their moms? The two previous chapters were built around a pair of admittedly freakish questions. What do schoolteachers and sumo wrestlers have in common? And how is the Ku Klux Klan like a group of real estate agents? But if you ask enough questions, strange as they may seem at the time, you may eventually learn something worthwhile. The first trick of asking questions is to determine if your question is a good one. Just because a question has never been asked does not mean it is good. Smart people have been asking questions for quite a few centuries now, so many of the questions that haven't been asked are bound to yield uninteresting answers. But if you can question something that people really care about and find an answer that may surprise them, that is, if you can overturn the conventional wisdom, then you may have some luck. It was John Kenneth Galbraith, the hyperliterate economic sage, who coined the phrase conventional wisdom. He did not consider it a compliment. "We associate truth with convenience," Galbraith wrote, "with what most closely accords with self-interest and personal well-being or promises best to avoid awkward effort or unwelcome dislocation of life. We also find highly acceptable what contributes most to self-esteem." Economic and social behavior, Galbraith continued, quote, "are complex, and to comprehend their character is mentally tiring. Therefore, we adhere, as though to a raft, to those ideas which represent our understanding." So the conventional wisdom, in Galbraith's view, must be simple, convenient, comfortable, and comforting, though not necessarily true. It would be silly to argue that the conventional wisdom is never true, but noticing where the conventional wisdom may be false, noticing, perhaps, the contrails of sloppy or self-interested thinking is a nice place to start asking questions. Consider the recent history of homelessness in the United States. In the early 1980s, an advocate for the homeless named Mitch Snyder took to saying that there were about 3 million homeless Americans. The public duly sat up and took notice. More than 1 of every 100 people were homeless? That sure seemed high, but, well, the experts said it. A heretofore quiescent problem was suddenly catapulted into the national consciousness. Snyder even testified before Congress about the magnitude of the problem. He also reportedly told a college audience that 45 homeless people die each second, which would mean a whopping 1.4 billion dead homeless every year. The U.S. population at the time was only about 225 million. Assuming that Snyder misspoke or was misquoted and meant to say that one homeless person died every 45 seconds, that's still 701,000 dead homeless people every year, or roughly one-third of all deaths in the United States. Ultimately, when Snyder was pressed on his figure of 3 million homeless, he admitted that it was a fabrication. Journalists had been hounding him for a specific number, he said, and he hadn't wanted them to walk away empty-handed. It may be sad but not surprising to learn that experts like Snyder can be self-interested to the point of deceit. But they cannot deceive on their own. Journalists need experts as badly as experts need journalists. Every day there are newspaper pages and television newscasts to be filled, and an expert who can deliver a jarring piece of wisdom is always welcome. Working together, journalists and experts are the architects of much conventional wisdom. Advertising, too, is a brilliant tool for creating conventional wisdom. Listerine, for instance, was invented in the 19th century as a powerful surgical antiseptic. It was later sold, in distilled form, as a floor cleaner and a cure for gonorrhea. But it wasn't a runaway success until the 1920s, when it was pitched as a solution for chronic halitosis, a then obscure medical term for bad breath. Listerine's new ads featured forlorn young women and men, eager for marriage but turned off by their mate's rotten breath. "Can I be happy with him in spite of that?" one maiden asked herself. Until that time, bad breath was not conventionally considered such a catastrophe. But Listerine changed that. As the advertising scholar James B. Twitchell writes, Listerine did not make mouthwash as much as it made halitosis. In just 7 years, the company's revenues rose from $115,000 to more than $8 million. However created, the conventional wisdom can be hard to budge. Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist and devout critic of George W. Bush, bemoaned this fact as the president's re-election campaign got underway in early 2004. Krugman wrote, "The approved storyline about Mr. Bush is that he's a bluff, honest, plain-spoken guy, and anecdotes that fit that story get reported. But if the conventional wisdom were instead that he's a phony, a silver spoon baby who pretends to be a cowboy, journalists would have plenty of material to work with." In the months leading up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, dueling experts floated diametrically opposite forecasts about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. But more often, as with Mitch Snyder's homeless statistics, one side wins the war of conventional wisdom. Women's rights advocates, for instance, have hyped the incidence of sexual assault, claiming that 1 in 3 American women will in their lifetime be a victim of rape or attempted rape. The actual figure is more like 1 in 8, but the advocates know it would take a callous person to publicly dispute their claims. Advocates working for the cures of various tragic diseases regularly do the same. Why not? A little creative lying can draw attention, indignation, and, perhaps most important, the money and political capital to address the actual problem. Of course, an expert, whether a women's health advocate or a political advertiser or an advertising executive, tends to have different incentives than the rest of us. And an expert's incentives may shift 180 degrees, depending on the situation. Consider the police. A recent audit discovered that the police in Atlanta were radically underreporting crime since the early 1990s. The practice apparently began when Atlanta was working to land the 1996 Olympics. The city needed to shed its violent image, and fast. So each year, thousands of crime reports were either downgraded from violent to nonviolent or simply thrown away. Despite these continuing efforts, there were more than 22,000 missing police reports in 2002 alone. Atlanta regularly ranks either number 1 or number 2 as the most violent American city. Police in other cities, meanwhile, were spinning a different story during the 1990s. The sudden, violent appearance of crack cocaine had police departments across the country scrapping for resources. They made it known that it wasn't a fair fight. The drug dealers were armed with state-of-the-art weapons and a bottomless supply of cash. This emphasis on illicit cash proved to be a winning effort, for nothing infuriated the law-abiding populace more than the image of the millionaire crack dealer. The media eagerly glommed on to this story, portraying crack dealing as one of the most profitable jobs in America. But if you were to have spent a little time around the housing projects where crack was so often sold, you might have noticed something strange. Not only did most of the crack dealers still live in the projects, but most of them still lived at home with their moms. And then you may have scratched your head and said, why is that? The answer lies in finding the right data. And the secret to finding the right data usually means finding the right person. More easily said than done. Drug dealers are rarely trained in economics. And economists rarely hang out with crack dealers. So the answer to this question begins with finding someone who did live among the drug dealers and managed to walk away with the secrets of their trade. Sudhir Venkatesh, his boyhood friends called him Sid, but he has since reverted to Sudhir, was born in India, raised in the suburbs of upstate New York and Southern California, and graduated from the University of California at San Diego with a degree in mathematics. In 1989, he began to pursue his PhD in sociology at the University of Chicago. He was interested in understanding how young people form their identities. To that end, he had just spent 3 months following the Grateful Dead around the country. What he was not interested in was the grueling fieldwork that typifies sociology. But his graduate advisor, the eminent poverty scholar William Julius Wilson, promptly sent Venkatesh into the field. His assignment? To visit Chicago's poorest black neighborhoods with a clipboard and a 70-question multiple-choice survey. This was the first question on the survey. How do you feel about being black and poor? A. Very bad. B. Bad. C. Neither bad nor good. D. Somewhat good. E. Very good. One day, Venkatesh walked 20 blocks from the university to a housing project on the shore of Lake Michigan to administer his survey. The project comprised three 16-story buildings made of yellow-gray brick. Venkatesh soon discovered that the names and addresses he had been given were badly outdated. These buildings were condemned, practically abandoned. Some families lived on the lower floors, pirating water and electricity, but the elevators didn't work. Neither did the lights in the stairwell. It was late afternoon in early winter, nearly dark outside. Venkatesh, who was a thoughtful, handsome, and well-built but not aberrationally brave person, had made his way up to the sixth floor, trying to find someone willing to take his survey. Suddenly, on the stairwell landing, he startled a group of teenagers shooting dice. They turned out to be a gang of junior-level crack dealers who operated out of the building, and they were not happy to see him. "I'm a student at the University of Chicago," Venkatesh sputtered, sticking to his survey script, "and I am administering..." "Fuck you, nigger, what are you doing in our stairwell?" There was an ongoing gang war in Chicago. Things had been violent lately, with shootings nearly every day. This gang, a branch of the Black Gangster Disciple Nation, was plainly on edge. They didn't know what to make of Venkatesh. He didn't seem to be a member of a rival gang, but maybe he was some kind of spy? He certainly wasn't a cop. He wasn't black, wasn't white. He wasn't exactly threatening. He was armed only with his clipboard. But he didn't seem exactly harmless either. Thanks to his 3 months trailing the Grateful Dead, he still looked, as he would later put it, like a genuine freak with hair down to my ass. The gang members started arguing over what should be done with Venkatesh. Let him go? But if he did tell the rival gang about this stairwell hangout, they'd be susceptible to a surprise attack. One jittery kid kept wagging something back and forth in his hands. In the dimming light, Venkatesh eventually realized it was a gun, and muttering, "Let me have him, let me have him." Venkatesh was very, very scared. The crowd grew bigger and louder. Then an older gang member appeared. He snatched the clipboard from Venkatesh's hands and, when he saw that it was a written questionnaire, looked puzzled. "I can't read any of this shit," he said. "That's because you can't read," said one of the teenagers, and everyone laughed at the older gangster. He told Venkatesh to go ahead and ask him a question from the survey. Venkatesh led with the "how does it feel to be black and poor" question. It was met with a round of guffaws, some angrier than others. As Venkatesh would later tell his university colleagues, he realized that the multiple-choice answers A through E were insufficient. In reality, he now knew, the answers should have looked like this. A, very bad. B, bad. C, neither bad nor good. D, somewhat good. E, very good. And F, fuck you. Just as things were looking their bleakest for Venkatesh, another man appeared. This was JT, the gang's leader. JT wanted to know what was going on. Then he told Venkatesh to read him the survey question. He listened, but then said he couldn't answer the question because he wasn't black. "Well then," Venkatesh said, "how does it feel to be African-American and poor?" "I ain't no African-American either, you idiot. I'm a nigger." JT then administered a lively, though not unfriendly, taxonomical lesson in, quote, nigger versus, quote, African-American versus, quote, black. When he was through, there was an awkward silence. Still, nobody seemed to know what to do with Venkatesh. JT, who was in his late 20s, had cooled down his subordinates, but he didn't seem to want to interfere directly with their catch. Darkness fell, and JT left. "People don't come out of here alive," the jittery teenager with the gun told Venkatesh. "You know that, don't you?" As night deepened, his captors eased up. They gave Venkatesh one of their beers, and then another and another. When he had to pee, he went where they went, on the stairwell landing one floor up. JT stopped by a few times during the night, but he didn't have much to say. Daybreak came, and then noon. Venkatesh would occasionally try to discuss his survey, but the young crack dealers just laughed and told him how stupid his questions were. Finally, nearly 24 hours after Venkatesh stumbled upon them, they set him free. He went home and took a shower. He was relieved, but he was also curious. It struck Venkatesh that most people, including himself, had never given much thought to the daily life of ghetto criminals. He was now eager to learn how the Black Disciples worked, from top to bottom. After a few hours, he decided to walk back to the housing project. By now, he had thought of some better questions to ask. Having seen firsthand that the conventional method of data gathering was in this case absurd, Venkatesh vowed to scrap his questionnaire and embed himself with the gang. He tracked down JT and sketched out his proposal. JT thought Venkatesh was crazy, literally, a university student wanting to cozy up to a crack gang. But he also admired what Venkatesh was after. As it happened, JT was a college graduate himself, a business major. After college, he had taken a job in Chicago's Loop District, working in the marketing department of a company that sold office equipment. But he felt so out of place there, like a white man working at Afro-Sheen headquarters, he liked to say, that he quit. Still, he never forgot what he learned. He knew the importance of collecting data and finding new markets. He was always on the lookout for better management strategies. It was no coincidence, in other words, that JT was the leader of this crack gang. He was bred to be a boss. After some wrangling, JT promised Venkatesh unfettered access to the gang's operations as long as JT retained veto power over any information that, if published, might prove harmful. When the yellow-gray buildings on the lakefront were demolished, shortly after Venkatesh's first visit, the gang relocated to another housing project even deeper in Chicago's south side. For the next 6 years, Venkatesh practically lived there. Under JT's protection, he watched the gang members up close, at work and at home. He asked endless questions. Sometimes the gangsters were annoyed by his curiosity. More often, they took advantage of his willingness to listen. "It's a war out here, man," one dealer told him. "I mean, every day people struggling to survive, so, you know, we just do what we can. We ain't got no choice, and if that means getting killed, well, shit, it's what niggers do around here to feed their family." Venkatesh would move from one family to the next, washing their dinner dishes and sleeping on the floor. He bought toys for their children. He once watched a woman use her baby's bib to sop up the blood of a teenage drug dealer who was shot to death in front of Venkatesh. William Julius Wilson, back at the U of C, was having regular nightmares on Venkatesh's behalf. Over the years, the gang endured bloody turf wars and, eventually, a federal indictment. A member named Booty, who was one rank beneath JT, came to Venkatesh with a story. Booty was being blamed by the rest of the gang for bringing about the indictment, he told Venkatesh, and therefore suspected that he would soon be killed. He was right. But first, Booty wanted to do a little atoning. For all the gang's talk about how crack dealing didn't do any harm, they even liked to brag that it kept black money in the black community, Booty was feeling guilty. He wanted to leave behind something that somehow might benefit the next generation. He handed Venkatesh a stack of well-worn spiral notebooks, blue and black, the gang's colors. They represented a complete record of 4 years' worth of the gang's financial transactions. At JT's direction, the ledgers had been rigorously compiled. Sales, wages, dues, even the death benefits paid out to the families of murdered members. At first, Venkatesh didn't even want the notebooks. What if the feds found out he had them? Perhaps he'd be indicted too. Besides, what was he supposed to do with the data? Despite his math background, he had long ago stopped thinking in numbers. Upon completing his graduate work at the University of Chicago, Venkatesh was awarded a 3-year stay at Harvard's Society of Fellows. Its environment of sharp thinking and bonhomie, the walnut paneling, the sherry cart once owned by Oliver Wendell Holmes, delighted Venkatesh. he went so far as to become the society's wine steward. And yet, he regularly left Cambridge, returning again and again to the crack gang in Chicago. This street-level research made Venkatesh something of an anomaly. Most of the other young fellows were dyed-in-the-tweed intellectuals who liked to pun in Greek. One of the society's aims was to bring together scholars from various fields who might not otherwise have occasion to meet. Venkatesh soon encountered another anomalous young fellow, one who also failed the society stereotype. This one happened to be an economist who, instead of thinking grand macro thoughts, favored his own list of offbeat micro curiosities. At the very top of his list was crime. And so, within 10 minutes of their meeting, Sudhir Venkatesh told Stephen Levitt about the spiral notebooks from Chicago, and they decided to collaborate on a paper. It would be the first time that such priceless financial data had fallen into an economist's hands, affording an unparalleled analysis of a heretofore uncharted criminal enterprise. Along with the bad pay, the foot soldiers faced terrible job conditions. For starters, they had to stand on a street corner all day and do business with crackheads. The gang members were strongly advised against using the product themselves, advice that was enforced by beatings if necessary. Foot soldiers also risked arrest and, more worrisome, violence. Using the gang's financial documents and the rest of Venkatesh's research, it is possible to construct an adverse events index of JT's gang during the 4 years in question. The results are astonishingly bleak. If you were a member of JT's gang for all 4 years, here is the typical fate you would have faced during that period. Number of times arrested, 5.9. Number of non-fatal wounds or injuries, not including injuries meted out by the gang itself for rules violations, 2.4. Chance of being killed, 1 in 4. A 1 in 4 chance of being killed. Compare these odds to being a timber cutter, which the Bureau of Labor Statistics calls the most dangerous job in the United States. Over 4 years' time, a timber cutter would stand only a 1 in 200 chance of being killed. Or compare the crack dealer's odds to those of a death row inmate in Texas, which executes more prisoners than any other state. In 2003, Texas put to death 24 inmates, or just 5% of the nearly 500 inmates on its death row during that time. Which means that you stand a greater chance of dying while dealing crack in a Chicago housing project than you do while sitting on death row in Texas. So, if crack dealing is the most dangerous job in America, and if the salary is only $3.30 an hour, why on earth would anyone take such a job? Well, for the same reason that a pretty Wisconsin farm girl moves to Hollywood. For the same reason that a high school quarterback wakes up at 5 a.m. to lift weights. They all want to succeed in an extremely competitive field in which, if you reach the top, you are paid a fortune, to say nothing of the attendant glory and power. To the kids growing up in a housing project on Chicago's South Side, crack dealing was a glamour profession. For many of them, the job of gang boss, highly visible and highly lucrative, was easily the best job they thought they had access to. Had they grown up under different circumstances, they might have thought about becoming economists or writers. But in the neighborhood where JT's gang operated, the path to a decent, legitimate job was practically invisible. 56% of the neighborhood's children lived below the poverty line, compared to a national average of 18%. 78% came from single-parent homes. Fewer than 5% of the neighborhood's adults had a college degree. Barely 1 in 3 adult men worked at all. The neighborhood's median income was about $15,000 a year, well less than half the U.S. average. During the years that Venkatesh lived with JT's gang, foot soldiers often asked his help in landing what they called a good job, that is, working as a janitor at the University of Chicago. The problem with crack dealing is the same as in every other glamour profession. A lot of people are competing for very few prizes. earning big money in the crack gang wasn't much more likely than the Wisconsin farm girls becoming a movie star or the high school quarterbacks playing in the NFL. But criminals, like everyone else, respond to incentives. So if the prize is big enough, they will form a line down the block